This is the Backlog Battle Podcast, episode 209.
Polish Blue Ribbon.
Welcome to another episode of the Backlog Battle Podcast. This is Alex.
And this is Daniel.
What's up, my man?
Not much. I got a new pop filter. Hopefully this one, you know, is better than the other one. I think it is. It's a higher quality one. This has like a wire mesh on it while the other one was fabric, so it should be a little better.
You know what's actually a really good pop filter?
What would that be?
Pantyhose.
Okay, is that what you use?
No, I do not. But it's the same material as pantyhose.
Not this. This is made with wire.
With wire?
Yeah.
I can't imagine how that would be better than
it
fabric.
It works better. The other one that I used didn't really work for shit, and that was made out of the same material as pantyhose, but this one seems to work a lot better.
Interesting. Okay. Can you pop your peas or attempt to?
Pap.
Okay. Wow. Impressive. Okay. I'm pretty sure like our listeners have can agree to that. So that's a good purchase. I mean, you know, it's a good test. You know, pop your peas and stuff. But
Pap's Blue Ribbon.
That's one way to do it, but seriously though, how have you been, man? Like it feels like it's been forever. Obviously, it's not, you know, since we last spoke. But you know,
it's been an eternity.
It's in black. That's my PSN name, by the way. I'm just
I wasn't even thinking that.
I don't. We're friends on PSN, right? Well, actually, no.
Yeah.
Are we?
Yeah, we are.
Okay. Yeah, that's the thing that I was kind of confused about. I'm like, wait, are we friends on PSN? Like, it'd be funny for, like, you know, the co-host.
No, yeah, we are.
Okay. Did you just check? Is that what just happened just now?
No. I remember that we were.
Okay, great. Okay, yeah. So, yeah, how have you been? Like, I heard from the Grapevine, which is my Twitter timeline, that you streamed and finished Shadow of the Colossus in one sitting.
Yeah, that's true. Last night, I wasn't planning on doing that, but that's just what happened.
I thought you were going to, like, you know, relish the game, not fucking do a speed run of it and be like, hey, I'm done.
I wasn't planning on it, but someone recommended, like, hey, you should stream Shadow of the Colossus, and I hadn't thought about it, but then when someone mentioned it, I was like, hey, yeah, that's a good idea. I love that game. It should make for a fun stream. So I did, thinking, oh, I'd probably stop around the halfway point. Not even the halfway point. I'd stop around, you know, beating a few of the Colossi, but then I kept playing and playing. And then eventually I was just like, wait, which Colossus am I on? Wait, what? I'm already on number 9? What? Well, shit. Let's keep playing. And then I beat the game.
Oh my God. Aren't there 16 of them? Like,
yeah, but you have to remember, I've beaten this game several times. Okay. So I know this game like the back of my hand. So I already know how to defeat all the Colossus. So someone else actually mentioned, like, oh, the first time I beat this game, it took me like 16 hours. Okay. And that sounds about right compared to when I first played the game. But, you know, that was back in high school. And I've beaten the PS2 version. I've beaten the PS3 version. Now I'm playing the PS4 version. I beat both of those versions multiple times on both normal and hard. So at this point, even though I might be a little bit rusty because I haven't played it in a while, hell, I even did Time Attack mode. Like, I played so much of Shadow of the Colossus, I even beat most of the Colossus, you know, in Time Attack mode. I think I actually beat all of them in Time Attack mode.
Jesus.
So, by this point, even though I'm a little rusty and I haven't played the game in years, a lot of that muscle memory is still there. So, I was able to just play through it and beat it. In one sitting.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, I'm surprised you didn't even like try like hard mode, because there is a hard mode to the game, right?
Yeah, there is a hard mode. That's because, again, I wasn't even thinking I was going to beat the game. I was just going to play some of it for the stream and that would be it. And that's not what happened.
Wow. Well, I mean, hopefully you enjoyed your $40 purchase.
Hey, there's still other things to do, like you said, hard mode. And plus, I didn't really take the time to appreciate the rest of the world. I didn't go out of my way to find any of the fruit trees or to get any of the lizards to increase the grip meter. I didn't bother to find all of the save shrines or anything like that, or to appreciate all the different vistas, like the beach and, you know, all the different environments in the game. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's still plenty to appreciate in the game.
Mm-hmm. And actually, like, I heard there's a special collectible that's only available in this version.
Huh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I actually read up on it somewhere where they said, like, yeah, they seem to have added some sort of collectible, and a lot of the fans don't know what it actually will yield. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's pretty nice. I wonder what that's going to be. Makes you wonder.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't see it in the game.
Ah, well,
so I mean, I don't know how to get it. I don't know what it is. So
I mean, yeah. That's the problem with streaming is that, you know, sometimes it's very purposeful when you're streaming. Like, you got, you know, like, I don't know, like, depending on like how you're playing the game or what kind of streamer you are, you're probably wanting to show the game off or you want to talk to your community and stuff like that. So it's, you know, it's really difficult to truly enjoy a game unless you are used to playing games with other people in the same room. You get what I'm saying? Like,
no, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Like, because I was also, I was also doing things I normally wouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm interacting with the chat, and as a result of that, I made a little more mistakes than I normally would have. And I'm also explaining things about the game. So there was parts where I would just kind of stop in my tracks and then be like, oh, by the way, did you know about this? Did you know about that? Because I'm knowledgeable about the game, not just about, you know, how to play and beat the game, but I'm also very knowledgeable about like the development of the game. I know about stuff that was cut out of the game. I know about, different theories about the game. So I was stopping and then going like, hey guys, there's a cut Colossus, and then over here it was going to be here, and but then this area is just a cliff because it was initially going to extend farther, and then you would have fought the Colossi there, but because the game was downsized, you know, you don't have access to that area, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, pretty cool. Very educational in that sense, you know. It's almost like you're giving a tour of the game while playing the game.
Yeah. I think that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Like, either way, I'm glad that you know, you have it and stuff. You did say on the show that you were going to pick it up and drop everything else, but...
Which I technically did!
Technically you did. You did, been practically... finished a game in one sitting. Congratulations. I guess you can go back to other games now. There you go.
Yes, I will go back to probably Horizon Zero Dawn, because that's what I've actually mainly been playing.
Yeah.
I'm like level 39 in that game.
Holy shit. Yeah, you're almost at a level cap. Holy cow.
Oh, wow. Really? I didn't know that.
Well, I mean, level 50, and I think level 60 if you have the expansion.
I do have the expansion.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, level 6. Well, I guess you're halfway there, I guess. But, I mean, it's still really fun, though. I mean, just hunting down the monsters and stuff and the tightness of the gameplay, I mean, that's... Man, it's...
So, in Horizon Zero Dawn, I've already collected all the metal flowers. Mm-hmm. I've found all the vantage points. I found all the artifacts, which are cups.
Wow. Yeah, they're cups, yeah. Do you like
Yeah, them? They're just, like, the guy that you trade them with, he's like, oh, I think they use them for beards, and you have to, you put the fluids in them, and it was like a ritual for cutting your beard. And Aloy was just like, maybe they just use them as cups. And he's like, no, foolishness.
So how are you finding these collectibles? Because I told you before that finding the collectibles is certainly, like, a thing that does create more context to the world, and even the vantage points as well. So, like, a lot of the side stuff really shows its hand, like what this current civilization actually is about and what they're dealing with.
So the vantage points in particular were interesting because they were usually just showing us stuff from back when before shit went down.
Mm-hmm.
And it was stuff like, oh, I used to live here and this was what my life was like and stuff like that. And I thought those were pretty nice. I thought they were neat because they give you a little visual and then you have a little audio log that you can listen to while you're appreciating the visual of what the world was like before the apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
But having like, for the metal flowers or the cups or anything like that, like I haven't read them. I haven't like read their descriptions or anything. So if there's any like interesting lore implications about them, like I haven't delved into that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I do have all of them.
Nice. That's really cool. The metal flowers, I'll tell you now without spoiling much, or anything actually, the metal flowers will probably make a lot more sense towards the end of the game. Because of the text that's actually there. You know, once you get to a specific point in the story, you'll be like, oh, okay, that's what that's all about. You know, so also you probably notice that the metal flowers are often found in maybe sometimes like in bushes that are shaped in very weird geometric shapes. Have you noticed that?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. They're surrounded by other flowers that are in like a shape, it'll be like maybe a triangle or a circle or mm-hmm. something like that.
Yeah. So that's actually a very interesting detail that they put there as well. Like I actually started only noticing that like, you know, maybe about halfway through collecting all of them. And I always thought like, huh, that's kind of weird. You know, it's very organized, you know, for what they're supposed to be. So, but, you know, needless to say, the mystery will at least be a little bit lifted once you get to the game.
In the main story, I don't want to spoil it, but mm-hmm. I did get to the point where we get the general explanation of why the apocalypse happened.
Okay.
So I went up to this building and then I saw these two holograms talking to each other, and it was a CEO and it was this woman.
Okay.
And
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Right, right. So I'm a little after that.
Wow. Okay. So that's a big bomb to have been dropped in the lab.
It was a big bomb, and it's one of the few moments so far in the story that made me go, "Oh, that's really cool. Like mm-hmm. that's interesting."
Mm-hmm. So now the interesting part is I don't know if you're at the part where now they're kind of rationalizing why everything exists, like why the machines have existed or why are there wildlife and all that stuff. They haven't talked about that yet, right?
Not quite.
Okay. All right. So now it's going to get really beefy because now you're like, okay, that's actually what happened. All right, cool. And then now you're being led through the story. And from here on out, it's going to be pretty interesting. Because I think what they've done in Horizon is the first half of it is a lot of like, okay, this is the situation you're in. Let's see how well you cope with it. And now that you're super comfortable with the environment, let's get to the real story. You know, like, especially like the origin of what happened and the culture, if you will.
Yeah. 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 Okay. Sounds cool.
Yeah. Also, like, you know, there is actually a logical explanation to the Nora tribe's name.
Well, okay. And that's not something I thought about, but okay.
Yeah. You will know what it is. It's kind of crazy.
Okay.
It's insane. It's insane, like, that once you finish the game, everything just kind of gels together and coalesces. And you're like, well, yeah, of course that's going to be what it is. Because, you know, so-and-so-and-so-and-so. You know, obviously I'm trying to be, you know, sneaky and not tell you details and stuff. But that's kind of, like, I feel the beauty of the game is, like, it just gel, like, everything just gels together all the way in the end. If you think about, you know, the different tribes and what happens to each of them, why some people are crazy, why people act certain ways. I mean, even now, just with
the, why one guy likes to drink oil.
Yes. You've gotten to that guy. Okay. Yes. Machine oil, for that matter, which is fucking insane. But maybe not.
Yeah,
so.
I actually completed his side quest, and by the end of it, he was just like, "No more stories. I'm gone." It was just like, "What the fuck?"
He's kind of crazy. Yeah, he's kind of insane. But I mean,
it was entertaining though. It was a fun side quest.
Yeah, and that's kind of like what I like about Horizon side stories is oftentimes they are kind of riddled with comedy. And you know, like, there's this guy, there's this two dudes for a side quest who want you to hunt two different things, but then if you come back and say you have both of them, they'll still argue anyway. And I'm like,
yeah, I actually did that one.
So you know what you're talking about. It's crazy.
Yeah, I remember that. That one gave me a chuckle.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. It's great because those are the kinds of moments where, yeah, there is an urgency to the world, maybe, sort of. But at the same time, it's like the game isn't afraid to, like, you know, rein in its seriousness and be like, all right, let's be silly a little bit because, you know, why not, you know?
Yeah. No, yeah. It's no fun to be super serious 100% of the time. It's nice to have a bit of levity.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, I mean, it seems like you're really enjoying it, and man, I can't
wait. Yeah, it's
good. Yeah, I can't wait until you get to the end and realize, like, what the fuck everything is. So you're gonna be like, holy shit, like...
Holy fuck.
Yeah, pretty much. So...
Yeah, I look forward to playing the rest, and also doing the Frozen Wilds DLC, which also looks good.
Yeah, so... I want to talk about the Frozen Wilds just for a tiny bit. I know we have a lot of things to talk about this episode, yeah. But
I haven't even like tried to enter the area yet. Like,
ooh, yeah,
I've completely ignored it. I'm waiting until I feel that my character is at like a sufficient level, because I heard that it's pretty difficult. So I'm like, all right, I'm gonna put it off. I'm gonna wait until I do like a bunch of quests and I level up and I learn like you know, enough moves where I feel comfortable and I'm like, okay, let's do it.
I'll tell you this. Even if you finish the game does this thing where it throws you back before the last mission after finishing the game. So you don't have to worry about like, oh shit, I got to do this before I finish the game. So don't worry about it.
Right. Okay. Yeah. That's good.
That's an important fact to know. Cause a lot of open world games sometimes are like, well, it's too fucking late. You know, you know, you gained all this experience during like the last mission and now, well, it's the end of the game. You can't use it anymore. No, that Horizon, fortunately, is not like that. It's just going to be like, all right, well, here you are. You're back to before this all happened. And enjoy the rest of the game. See ya. Yeah, which is great. By the way, so we're talking about the Frozen Wilds. Did you know that the Frozen Wilds was actually made within like an amazing 8 months?
Wow. Cool.
Right? I mean, from somebody who does a lot of research on game development and whatnot, how does that make you feel now that you know that fact? It's kind of crazy to think about, right?
I mean, I haven't experienced it myself, so I can't like fully appreciate that fact. But I mean, it does sound impressive to do that.
Mm-hmm. So basically, like they said that, you know, because when, you know, backtracking, when Horizon came out, there was no season pass. In fact, there wasn't even any plans for any sort of DLC. It was after a fact, like about 2 or 3 weeks later, that Guerrilla said that they want to make an expansion for it. And of course, they, I think, officially announced it at E3. And they even gave it a name plus a release date and stuff. And it was really tight. Like, they basically said, all right, November, it's coming out, you know. And I don't know if it suffered any delays or anything like that, but it was just like, okay. And then at the PlayStation Experience, Herman Holst, you know, who's the guy who runs Guerrilla, basically said, like, yeah, we had a very rigid 8 to 9 months where we made the game from scratch, you know, like literally, like we went on vacation, then went back and created the DLC. And I'm like thinking to myself, wow. Because we're talking about a huge landmass here, like a fairly significant amount of land, plus with new monsters, by the way, new machines in that area.
So, yeah, I was going to say, like, I imagine it's almost all new assets.
Yes, actually, like I don't want to say like what kind of animals there are in there because, you know, spoilers and stuff, but it's a pretty sizable area. That being said, from a design standpoint, I can kind of see where they quote unquote made shortcuts. And this shouldn't be misconstrued as an insult to the game because I think the rest of the game is really solid. But you'll notice that the Frozen Wilds is very mountainous. And, you know, you probably know of draw distance and all that stuff. Maybe, you know, my conjecture is the reason why it's very mountainous is to limit the draw distance that it has to draw, you know, from like in certain angles.
Right.
You get what I'm saying? So you don't have to test that, if you will, and make sure that, oh, you know, there's too many trees that's being drawn. Maybe we should, you know, maybe we should adjust the engine a little bit. So So because of that, it's very challenging to kind of look at it from the standpoint of like, hey, the game is so solid, but then you go to the Frozen Wilds, it really is unforgiving in many different ways. But also you could tell, at least for me, that you could tell that they made this within 8 to 9 months, which is not to say that it's bad. It's bad or good, by the way. I think it's actually pretty good.
I mean, there are plenty of games that were made in a short amount of time that turned out well. I mean, Tales of Berseria was made in under a year.
Mm-hmm.
Resident Evil 3 was made in like 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So, and those are great games. So,
agreed.
There you go.
Yeah. But the reason why I'm calling attention to this isn't necessarily because of how amazing, you know, like the Frozen Wilds turn out to be, but something that a lot of people aren't considering about why the Horizon Zero Dawn team did this to begin with. And I think this will pique your interest because it does involve one other studio that is involved with Guerrilla Games, which is Kojima Productions. Yeah, so this is something that is obviously not talked about in any circle whatsoever. So you guys are hearing this only on the Backlog Battle podcast. Okay.
Oh, shit. Exclusive.
So when I played, well, specifically my girlfriend played, like, Frozen Wilds, we kind of sat down and kind of examined the entirety of that game. And really, it was made within 8 to 9 months. But the curious thing is that during the PlayStation Experience, Hideo Kojima and several of his, like, partners actually said and praised that the development of, you know, of Death Stranding was actually proceeding surprisingly fast for a Kojima game. And that made me think, you know, like really, really hard. Like I re-looked at all the videos about Horizon Zero Dawn, GDC trailers and whatnot, and really thought about it carefully as to why they actually made the Frozen Wilds, the true reason why they made the Frozen Wilds. You know what I came up with, Daniel?
What did you come up with?
It was an exercise. It was a way... Okay, ask me the question. Sorry, I butt in there.
No, it's okay. So, my assumption then would be, I'm guessing, is it because this was their way of seeing how they would work together?
No. It is testing... No, okay. It was testing the robustness of the engine to create content in a very decreased amount of time, in a rapid span.
Because
normally, when DLC is made, they're usually done consciously about 2 or 3 months before. Planning stages usually happen a few weeks or even months before the actual release of a game. Horizon Zero Dawn's Frozen Wilds never had that luxury. So the whole, you know, next few months, the 8-9 months that Herman Hulst actually said, that is true. They literally did not have any plans to make an expansion. They just made it within that 8 to 9 months. Story, voice acting, asset creation, landmass creation, quest line, you name it. That was all 8 to 9 months. Why would you subject yourself, if you're basically a company that just released like a great new IP, to the stresses of having to make a new quote-unquote expansion for a game for 8 to 9 months? There really isn't any benefit, because you're already making a lot of money. And the $15 you're going to earn from the expansion, that's cool. But that seems to be almost chump change. You know, like I was
actually, I think it's 20.
Okay, so $20. It's still pretty much chump change, in my opinion, you know, compared to most. It's still very substantial. But I saw this as more of an exercise. And the reason why I frame it as an exercise is it's basically them testing how fast they can basically make content or new content with a game engine that's already up and running. So it's more of a case study than anything else. And yes, it turned out like to be a really good expansion, but I think this is their way of saying, like, look, we were able to basically make an expansion from scratch and release it within 8 to 9 months, not have to do anything else other than, you know, the usual rigmarole and stuff, and the engine was able to handle it. And this correlates with the whole, you know, notion and the statements that we've been hearing about Kojima's project, saying that his game, Death Stranding, is actually in production and far along enough in production that even Sony themselves are surprised how far along it is in its production.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. I'm glad. I mean, I wasn't expecting this game to come out for like a while.
Yeah. I mean, the other statement that correlates this idea was the fact that Mark Cerny, who is, of course, the chief architect of PlayStation, basically said he's already played the first 5 hours and that he actually understood all the metaphors that were being shown in the trailers within that first 5 hours of the game. I mean, that's how far along.
Yeah, I remember hearing that.
Yeah, that's a big deal. That means the Decima engine is so damn robust that even a brainiac, an insane person like Hideo Kojima is able to really maximize the use out of it. That's insane. That's really crazy to think about, you know?
I'm sure Kojima appreciates it as well, because he spent so much fucking time making the Fox engine only for it to be ripped away from him.
Yeah, I know, right? But, you know,
now he has a brand new engine that he can play around with.
Mm-hmm. That apparently is allowing him to make his game faster. That's, I think, that's the biggest takeaway that I have from this, Daniel. He's able to make his game faster. And actually, he's able to kind of, I mean, this is obviously positing, but like, I'm guessing that because he's able to build this thing faster, he's certainly getting a lot less hurdles to make the game however he wants to make at this point, as opposed to like all the kind of bottlenecking that Konami was doing with Metal Gear Solid 5. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm really excited, because I'm almost of the mind that we might see gameplay of Death Stranding as soon as this E3.
I'm excited.
Yeah.
I want to make sense out of all those insane trailers. I actually sat my sister down one day and I showed her all the Death Stranding trailers. And we just spent like a good like 20 minutes just talking about how insane the trailers were.
Right? It still
and
is.
It was fun. It was fun just like sitting her down and I'm like, Ashley, just watch. And by the end, she was just like, there's so much to unpack. There's so much to say. And yet I know nothing.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the nth level of Kojima madness. It's kind of crazy.
This is Kojima unhinged.
No kidding. Like his jaw unhinged kind of situation, I think.
Yes, which means it can be either an amazing thing or a horrible thing or a crazy mix of the two.
Yeah.
You'll have to wait.
Yeah, we will have to wait. I do feel, though, that E3 of this year is going to be huge. Because guess who else is actually showing up at E3 this year, Daniel?
Oh, snap. What? Who?
CD Projekt Red.
Oh shit, Cyberpunk.
Yeah, I know, right? It's here. It's coming. It seems like they're ready to show something. We probably won't see, like, you know, Cyberpunk until December. Maybe they'll just have people talk about it. Because the way that CD Projekt Red usually does these things is that they'll show people at E3, and then, you know, the press will get content and footage within the next few months after that. Because, you know, if I remember in The Witcher 3, they did show us The Witcher 3 at E3, I want to say 2013 or 2012. I don't quite remember. And then...
Yeah, I don't remember.
And then... towards the end of 2013 and the beginning of 2014, that's when they start showing footage of it, you know, and that's when we're like, okay, that's the press cycle that you're going into. Because, you know, I'm pretty sure, you know, the people covering whatever game they're announcing, you know, pretty damn sure it's Cyberpunk, but I'm just gonna ignore, you know, just play that.
It's gotta
play,
be.
Yeah, I'm just gonna play dumb though, Daniel, and be like, oh, maybe it's something else.
Maybe it's The Witcher 4.
Maybe, you know, and, you know, I'm pretty sure they'll serve us, you know, or whoever is attending, you know, peanuts and, you know, like Polish beer, because that's usually their mantra, which, by the way,
I've never had Polish beer.
It's... was it really Polish beer, or was it just like Pabst Blue Ribbon? I don't actually remember.
Pabst Blue Ribbon?
Jesus. I mean, I don't remember. It's been a long time. I mean, it's been 5 years since, you know, it's since I've seen the guys again, but it might just be Pabst Blue Ribbon. But anyways, it's...
That's sad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they can't smuggle Polish beer into the freaking country for E3, man.
Why not? Just do it.
I don't know.
Why not?
Maybe they did. Like I said, my memory is hazy. I remember being very drunk during the Witcher 3 press conference and just really, like, you know, absorbing everything that I was watching on screen. So how's that?
Hey, man. If you were drunk, that sounds like it was a good time.
It's always... It's always a good time with the CG Projekt Red, guys. But anyways.
Yeah.
So, we have a lot to talk about today, and we're going to basically be talking about the entirety, or most of it, of Console Wars, the audiobook and book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I'm really excited about this because I truly enjoyed the book, Daniel. This book is...
Yes! Really... I'm so glad you did.
Dude, like, I was actually super sad when I finished the book, because the way that they left it, it was like, it was this, you know, like, you know how in
it's
most...
It's sad.
It's sad, but also, don't you think, like, sometimes in most books, generally speaking, in most books, when they... finish the book, there's this kind of uneasy uncertainty, you know, between, like, all the protagonists and the antagonists, if there are any, you know, and, you know, that pervade, right? And you're just not sure what's gonna happen. Because Console Wars is steeped in history, you know what happens to Sega, you know what happens to Sony, and you know what happens to Nintendo. So it's really striking when it ends the way that it ends. And of course, you know, like, Blake J. Harris actually kind of responded to me when I said that it was kind of a sad ending, and he said, like, he felt the same way, and that, but he was kind of relieved that a lot of the protagonists kind of went off in the directions that they did and found success through, you know, their future endeavors and stuff. But, you know, it's interesting to me that even the author agrees with the sentiment that the book does end in a very somber note, but at the same time, a very forward-looking note, you know? Like, even how it ends with Kalinske basically saying, like, maybe it's time to move on, that sort of thing. It's not necessarily framed as a sad kind of thing, like, of him leaving, but more of, like, I think it's sad because of what could have been. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And the thing is with what happens in the book is that, like, Kalinske, he fucking tried his best, man. And if only they fucking listened to him, things would have turned out so much better. Things would have been so much different. I don't think it would be a stretch to say that a good deal of the gaming landscape would be very different now if Sega of Japan just listened to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because look what happened. If it wasn't for the fact that Sega and Sony, like the if they worked it out, things could have been so different. We would have had the Sega PlayStation or something crazy like that instead of Sony becoming their own competitor.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually what ended up happening was Sega couldn't keep up with Sony and they, you know, fell out of the console market entirely because the PS2 just kicked the Dreamcast's ass.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the interesting thing is, you know, just for context, for the people who are listening, Tom Kalinske was the CEO of Sega of America. You know, and, you know, mm-hmm. not to talk about it too much, but Nakayama, who is the guy who runs Sega of Japan, basically literally flew himself to Hawaii to ask Kalinske to join Sega to run Sega of America, taking over Michael Katz's position, who was, by the way, the guy responsible for the Sega does what Nintendo don't ads and all that stuff. Kalinske, in case people don't know, he was a huge guy in Mattel. He was responsible for, like, the revival of Barbie as a brand and also the creation of He-Man and the She-Ra series. So they had, like, another franchise to, you know, stand tall with. And, of course, you know, something happens with Kalinske in Mattel that ousts him out of the company. And so now this guy from Japan wants him to run Sega of America. And that's basically the whole entirety of the story, really, you know. But
I mean, just think about that, though. He went out of his way to find Kalinske and convince him to become the president of Sega of America. Because mm-hmm. that's how much he trusted him. And look how well that paid off, where Sega of America was such a top dog during the 90s, the console wars between Sega Genesis, Super Nintendo. That was monumental what mm-hmm. what Kalinske did.
Mm-hmm. Do you want
to
talk about
they didn't listen to him.
Yeah. Do you want to talk a little
this
bit about
blows
like,
my mind.
You want to talk about like the successes that he had? Because I feel like we need to contextualize this with the successes. Because it is, you know, for both of us who have read the book, it is truly mind-blowing of what he's done. But give us an idea of, like, what he's done for Sega.
So I think one of the very first contributions that he made, which is one of the most important, is when Sega of Japan sent Kalinske the art that they had for Sonic the Hedgehog, he knew immediately, right away, that this wasn't going to appeal to the Western market. Sonic the Hedgehog originally had a girlfriend named Madonna, and he was in a rock band, and he had teeth, and he looked like a werewolf, and there's some weird shit like that.
Basically like a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles reject.
Yeah, like a bad one.
Mm-hmm.
And Kalinske knew right away, like, this wasn't going to appeal. And he transformed Sonic into the Sonic that we know and love now. So everyone who's a Sonic fan listening to this, thank Kalinske, because the version of Sonic that you love, he's responsible for. He's the one that created Sonic, his personality, his attitude. You know, that Sonic that you know and love, that was all him. That was his creation. Like, obviously, he didn't come up with the design. The design remained relatively the same, although it was modified. But that attitude, you know, of Sonic, like, that was him.
Mm-hmm.
That should tell you a lot.
It would also be remiss to say that it's, you know, it's all him. Because the team that he assembled at Sega of America, which basically includes Al Nielsen and the numerous other collaborators that Kalinske had at Sega of America, really were responsible for a lot of the successes of, you know, of the company, Sega of America. Mm-hmm. Compared to Sega of Japan, because they were literally like almost like a pirate ship, you know, in a way, and you know, where they could just basically do whatever the hell they want, and it actually worked out. Like the one kind of crazy thing that they did that I remember from the book is when they were trying to convince Walmart to basically like carry Sega Genesis consoles on their market, but couldn't because they wanted to support Nintendo or they didn't believe in the Genesis. So they basically like opened up Sega shops or Sega arcade things, if you will, all over Walmart's home state, so that that way, like literally even building like one of those places across from the main headquarters of Walmart, just to make a point and saying like, hey, all these people are playing Sega games. Why isn't Walmart carrying it? You know, you remember that?
Yes, I remember.
Yeah, it's crazy, but they did it. Like they actually eventually did. And
yeah, eventually they broke down Walmart to the point where like the guy, the liaison between Walmart and Sega eventually called Kalinske and he's like, dude, fine, whatever, you win. We'll accept Sega Genesis. My boss is yelling at me over this. Like,
mm-hmm. Right.
He's like, why are we carrying Sega Genesis?
Mm-hmm. And if it sounds like we're telling a story of a rip-roaring, like, kind of adventure, swashbuckling, you know, kind of thing. It kind of sounds like it. You know, the way that we've described the story, it is kind of like, you know, like the underdogs trying to basically like take over like this. It's almost like 1984, you know, the story of 1984, mm-hmm. Except of course
George Orwell.
Yeah, George Orwell, except it's, you know, from the viewpoint of Sega trying to overthrow like the quote-unquote evil Nintendo, you know what I mean? But
sure,
the crazy part,
I was actually gonna say, like, I wasn't even a Sega kid growing up. Like, I was a Nintendo kid growing up. I loved my Super Nintendo. I still love my Super Nintendo. But God damn it, I was rooting for Sega reading this book. And I guarantee even the biggest Nintendo fanboy, if you read this book, you can't help but root for Kalinske and Sega.
Yeah, because they were just doing everything right. Like, you know, like another kind of tidbit from the book that would be rather interesting, and there's obviously more details than what we're talking about in the book, by the way, is, you know, you talked about their potential partnership with Sony earlier that went awry because Sega of Japan just didn't believe in it. When Sega was forcing the Saturn and willing it into existence, like Sega of Japan, excuse me, and Kalinske was trying to court, you know, like SGI to use their technology for their platform, you know, and then. Of course, I knew what it was all about. I knew what Silicon Graphics Incorporated was responsible for. You know, I was really into, like, you know, watching and reading news about video games even back in the 90s. So I knew exactly what was going to happen. And then when Sega of Japan said no, and essentially Kalinske called SGI and gave the number to Peter Main, I was like, oh, man. They could have even gotten the technology that ran behind the Nintendo 64. Are you fucking kidding me? So they had...
It's nuts!
Yeah, it's two opportunities to basically move forward in the market and become industry leaders. This is insane, you know?
But they... it's so frustrating. It's like they just didn't listen to him. And he was right.
Yeah. Kalinske was right in both accounts.
But I think part of it was Sega of Japan were frustrated and jealous of the success of Sega of America, so they didn't want to accept his help,
mm-hmm.
because they were butthurt,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
And it, you know, to their credit, I will say this: in Japan, the Sega Saturn actually was successful,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't over here.
Yeah,
it died. Mm-hmm. A silent death.
It was also modified from the Japanese release. I remember, you know, one of the things that separated the American, you know, Saturn from the Japanese one is the memory expansion slot, which actually allowed, you know, Capcom games to be run in surprisingly smooth frame rates in the Japanese Saturn, but in the United States, it couldn't do such thing for some reason. You know,
wow.
Yeah, because
so we got a gimped Saturn.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, because I remember that. Like, I remember a lot of people saying at the time, like, yeah, you should get the Japanese Saturn. I'm like, why is that? Because the expansion slots are actually going to make like all these like 2D games run good. And of course, you look at the Japanese Capcom games of yore, which, by the way, it is said in the book that Sega was banking on 2D graphics at the time to still basically take over like 3D, which was such a kind of dumbass bet if you ask me now. It's like, what? Like, we're at the cusp of 3D and you're gonna put all your eggs in 2D, which is, they're great. I mean,
absurd.
Yes, 2D animations on Saturn games, Japanese Saturn games, are fantastic. I mean, you've seen a lot of Capcom's games during that era. They're great. But it didn't lead us to Final Fantasy VII, and that's where Sony comes in, you know? And that's just like...
Not only that, but the Saturn was notoriously difficult to code for.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. I remember watching a video by Digital Foundry. I don't normally watch their videos, but their DF Retro line of videos are fantastic. And on one of the videos, it showcases Tomb Raider, and it shows the Sega Saturn version. And apparently, like, he goes in and he explains a little bit about how doing 3D graphics, how it works on the Saturn. And it's this really bizarre technology, this really strange technique where it's actually like a weird collection of sprites that are on screen, and they're warped in a way that looks like it's 3D. Like, it's nuts. It's crazy.
Wow.
So, like, the Saturn was this fucking monstrosity that you know, you had to, like, just do weird stuff in order to get it to do 3D correctly. It was weird.
Yeah. And it's interesting to kind of think about, too. What's interesting to think about, too, in this book is the reluctance of the Japanese. And I feel like this is, you know, this is going to be like one of those things that we're going to be talking about in the next topic we're going to be talking about. And we're not transitioning to that yet. But think about how the reluctance of the Japanese to do anything outside of their status quo. Right? Like, I'm not also just necessarily talking about the Japanese, you know, like, who are responsible for, you know, Sega of Japan, right? Because if you remember, do you remember the story, by the way, of when Al Nilsson went out to drink with, like, his Japanese
I was just thinking about that.
Do you want to tell the story? Because I do want to kind of remember it and stuff. And I only remember parts of it.
So, basically, Al Nilsson went out to eat and drink with a bunch of Sega of Japan employees. And as a joke, one of them ordered this, I think it was a puffer fish.
It was fugu, yeah.
It was fugu, yeah. Which is notorious for being a poisonous fish. And if you don't cut it, like, just right, you could get sick. And at worst, it might kill you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, apparently, it doesn't really happen that often. I think the numbers were like maybe 10 out of 100 might get sick. You know, and it's rare for anyone to actually die from it.
Right.
But it is possible. And then instead of being like, oh, you know, I'm not going to take the risk, Al Nilsson is just like, fuck that shit, and he ate it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this moment of realization for him, because they had ordered it as a joke, not thinking that he would actually do it.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. And they looked in shock and awe. And then when he offered, he's like, oh, it's good. Do you want some? All of them were like, no way.
Mm-hmm.
And the realization for him there was they're not going to take the risk. And that's why Sega of Japan isn't doing as well as Sega of America, because they're not willing to take the risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another story that's in the book, and I'm not going to take up too much more of our time on this subject matter, is when the book starts talking about Sony. You know, if you remember, there was a big deal at Sony as well during this time, because they were reluctant in joining the console arms race. Remember? You know? And basically, like, what happened was Ken Kutaragi just basically dragged them all into it by, you know, creating a small kind of, you know, department where he's literally making the PlayStation away from the boardroom's like prying eyes. And then, you know, he would just basically present it, be like, ta-da, it's done, you know? And it's crazy to think that Japan is run by a bunch of people who just don't want to take risks. You know what I mean? Like, it's crazy to think about. Because, again, it's not, you know, the game that, I mean, the game, I'm sorry, the book. Because there's a running theme with the book, you know, that I noticed, which is a lot of the Japanese are very risk averse, right? Like, you know, even Nintendo, I mean, it's well documented that Nintendo is very risk averse, right? Like, they'll stay within their status quo unless push comes to shove. Towards the end of the book, they're actually forced to actually create real marketing campaigns as opposed to just showing off gameplay of games. Remember that, like in a book?
Well, another thing to consider is Nintendo wanted to coast on the NES for a lot longer.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until the Sega Genesis started to prove to be a force to be reckoned with that forced their hand and create the Super Nintendo.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, it's kind of crazy to think how those powers, you know, actually even existed at the time, because if you're not gonna take a risk, then what kind of business are you? You know, where it's a crazy thought process to even think about this. And I think the biggest difference is that, you know, in Sony, there were people, even there were Japanese people behind the scenes that just really wouldn't stand for, like, the kind of, how should I put this, conservatism that their corporate masters have, and just like said, like, you know, along with Olufsen, by the way, basically, like, just said, like, we're going into this console thing whether you guys like it or not. Here's the console, by the way, what do you think? You know, like, that sort of attitude. Whereas Sega of America versus Sega of Japan, it's like almost like every single time, you know, like, Kalinske and friends would needed to do something, you know, Japan was just like, well, cool. And then towards the end, as far as, like, the Sega Saturn goes, it was pretty much a failure. And to be quite honest, like, in the last part of the book where Nakayama and Kalinske talked and spoke to each other and stuff, like, you know, and they just basically, like, ended their conversation with Kalinske basically implying that he's going to be leaving, and Nakayama just really disappointed. It's like,
yeah,
what did you expect? You hired him.
Yeah,
you hired him to make a change, and you overruled him. Yeah, exactly. Thank you. And you know the crazy part about this, Daniel? And this is the most craziest part now. Because the story, even though, like, we're so well-versed in it thanks to Console Wars, we're now well-versed into the effects of it. And there's been many, many more articles talking about how Sega stopped being a first-party hardware manufacturer than most of what's talked about in Console Wars. Like, I remember several, you know, years ago reading an article that interviewed Peter Moore and how Sega of Japan, for maybe the first time in a long time since Kalinske, sat him down and asked him whether Sega was going to be, whether Sega need to drop the Dreamcast or continue as a third party or continue with the Dreamcast. It lied solely on his shoulders. And of course, you know, and which is why a lot of people unfairly kind of, you know, put the onus on him as destroying, like, Sega. And I don't think that's the case, actually. I think he was making a smart decision by basically saying, look, nobody's making games for the Dreamcast apart from us. You know, we make a lot of money from, like, licensing our platform and third-party games. The biggest third-party game manufacturer, EA, at the time, doesn't want to make games for us. It's all for us to lose, you know?
So, yeah, I have to agree. I don't really think it was his fault that the Dreamcast turned out the way it did. I mean, and the fact of the matter is, it wasn't doing that well, and they needed to move on. And it was also, I guess I'd also have to say, like, a big problem with the Dreamcast was, while it was really powerful when it first came out, I think they blew their wad a little too soon, so to speak, because right afterwards, the PS2 came out, and it was, like, basically, like, two times as powerful.
Allegedly, but, like, I still kind of contend, like, that the Dreamcast had a lot of really good things going for it. Like, anti-aliasing was a huge thing because, you know, it's funny because if I remember correctly, a lot of the kind of tech demos that the PlayStation 2 had were literally just tech demos. Like, the console really couldn't do much a little bit better than the PlayStation 1, and in a way, like, a little bit more than the Dreamcast even. Because if you remember, I don't know if you even actually remember this, but remember the tech demo where they were literally rendering Sid's face from Final Fantasy Spirits Within using the PS2?
No, I don't remember that.
Yeah, so they rendered Sid's face from Final Fantasy Spirits Within, just his face, using the PlayStation 2, but that's it. Like, you actually can't render that face in that high detail along with an actual background, a body, and all that stuff. But because people were so hyped that the quote-unquote PS2 could actually do this, people got fooled and, of course, waited for the PlayStation 2, by the way, including myself, and actually waited for the PlayStation 2 to come out. You know, and the Dreamcast, on the other hand, you're right, they blew their load pretty early on because, you know, but also I think more importantly, it underscores the importance of third-party development, you know? And the reason why I say this is because, really, the Dreamcast had a lot of first-party games, and that's really about it. Like, Activision with its support, like, supported it a little bit, but then...
Hey, Game Arts put Grandia 2 on the Dreamcast.
Yeah.
And that is a great game. Way better than the shitty PS2 port that came afterwards. That PS2 port sucks.
And that's kind of, like, where I'm coming from. You know, like, you say that the PlayStation 2 is twice more powerful than the Dreamcast, but is that actually true? And I posit it's actually not.
I was just throwing out that number. I don't know. I don't know actually how much more powerful it is.
Yeah. And the answer is really not so much. You know, it's kind of probably even. I mean, don't quote me on this, but I feel like, you know, if you compare games, you know, side by side on the Dreamcast and the PlayStation 2, you'd argue that the Dreamcast version looks, you know, a slight bit better. You know what I'm saying?
Well, with Grandia 2 specifically, yeah, the Grandia 2 version looks good, but looks a lot better. But that's mostly because the PS2 version wasn't optimized at all. It was just a bad port. They just didn't do a good job.
Right. I guess there's that too. So,
plus, like, you say they're about even. I don't know if I agree with that. Like, can the Dreamcast run a game like Final Fantasy 12? I kind of doubt it.
I mean, that's I feel like a crazy thing that, you know, to even ask right now, because, like, now we're gonna have to, like, look at, you know, specs for both and stuff. But even then, you know, it doesn't really matter if even regardless of the specs and stuff, like, you know, the games aren't optimized properly. You know,
well, I think the main thing that the reason why the PS2 beat the shit out of the Dreamcast was mainly the DVD drive.
That's one of the
biggest reasons, because you had people that weren't interested in the PS2 as a gaming console buying it as a DVD player because it was one of the cheapest DVD players on the market when it came out.
That's true. Okay, so I had to look up the specs because we wouldn't drop it. So the clock speed of the Dreamcast is 200 megahertz. The clock speed of the PlayStation is 300 megahertz. Okay. The memory on the Dreamcast is 16 meg. The memory on the PlayStation is 32. And here's the kind of the crazy part, though. The video RAM of the Dreamcast is 8 megabytes, but the video RAM of the PlayStation is 4.
Yeah. Weird.
Mm-hmm. And also, the more interesting part is that there is an available clock speed for both. So, for the graphics card, quote-unquote, for the Dreamcast, it's 100 megahertz, and on the PlayStation, it's 150 megahertz. Now, we could say all these, like, stats all we want. You know, really, like, at the end of the day, it's how they were implemented, right? And I think you bring up a very important point about, like, you know, Final Fantasy XII probably not being able to be, like, you know, present on the Dreamcast, if ever. But even, like, other games that we even probably should have mentioned earlier, like Shadow of the Colossus on PS2, Like, is that even going to be possible in the Dreamcast? That's kind of a crazy idea, you know?
Yeah, so, I don't think so.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously we'll probably never know because, you know, it's just the nature of the beast. It's like one of those things, you know, like we can ask ourselves, you know, shoulda, woulda, coulda. But
I'm kind of like picturing Shadow of the Colossus on the Dreamcast, but instead of Wander being like the highly detailed like model that he is, it's like one of the chibi like Grandia 2 character models instead, with like the stubby arms.
It's terrible.
It doesn't even have a mouth and it's just eyes.
Yeah. I want to kind of close out this conversation by saying, like, it's, you know, from a historical standpoint, Console Wars is a great book. It's really long.
Absolutely.
Though. Yeah. It's really long, though.
it's a thick book.
Yeah. And even, like, the audiobook is, like, hours long. Like, it's almost a day long, right?
I think it's, like, 20 hours.
Yeah. It's 20 hours. But if you were a kid growing up, you know, during that era, or even, like, you're a Sega, Nintendo fan, or a Sony fan, or whatever, or even if you're just curious about, you know, video games in general and the history of it, especially if you grew up in that era, consider getting Console Wars, even if it's not, you know, even if it's just like on Kindle or even like Audible and stuff. And if you do, please use our link, which is bit.ly/AmazonBacklogBattle, all one word. Once again, that is bit.ly/AmazonBacklogBattle, all one word. And if you do start subscribing to Audible from, you know, from this link, you do get one free book as a credit, you know, one credit, and you can use that towards Console Wars, and, you know, you would have paid for like a really, really awesome book. I mean, I recommend it. Daniel recommends it. It's pretty good, right?
Great book. Highly recommended.
Yeah. And just FYI, the author, Al Nielsen and Tom Kalinske, are all on Twitter. So, I mean, I just noticed that, like, when I started tweeting about the book and I started getting likes from Tom Kalinske and Al Nielsen when I mentioned Blake Harris. And of course, Blake is a great guy. Like, he has another book coming out, which is all about VR, and it's coming out this summer. So that's going to be pretty exciting, I think. It'll be...
I didn't realize those two were on Twitter. I gotta follow them now.
What? You didn't... Wow. Okay. Yeah, because...
I didn't know. But now that I know, I gotta follow them.
Yeah, he actually retweeted, like, my 5-star ratings on Audible and stuff, and he's like, look at all those stars. And I'm like, yes, Tom, thank you.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And certainly, like, really cool people and stuff. Like, and Al Nielsen, I know we kind of mention him here and there and stuff. Like, I feel like, you know, Batman has his Robin. I feel like Al Nielsen was, like, you know, the Robin to Kalinske's Batman. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah, certainly. So, I want to transition this to a topic that, you know, might be controversial. And I know that a lot of people are used to our former co-host Anthony being very controversial, but I think this one is particularly so because it possibly affects an entire nation of people. I've been, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with my girlfriend over the past couple of weeks talking about my views in about Japanese development, to the point where she kind of called me out as racist.
Oh, damn.
It was pretty bad. But, you know, first of all, like, it's interesting to be called that by your partner, first of all. And second of all, it made me actually take a deeper inventory of my feelings towards Japanese development and the culture as a whole. Because we did try talking about this last week, but I feel like we weren't ready to really talk about it because there were a lot of missing pieces. A lot of, you know, both of us were just kind of, you were actually taken aback by a lot of it and certainly weren't ready to talk about it in any depth whatsoever, admittedly.
I didn't agree with some of the stuff you said. Yeah.
But now I actually have ammo to fuel my gun to kind of basically rationalize why this is happening. In particular, I wanted to kind of frame this as more of a statement. And my thesis, and I know this sounds so boring the way that I'm stating it, is why Western gamers might never have their way with how they want to play Japanese games. That's pretty strong and very definitive, don't you think?
It's quite a mouthful.
Yeah. So I want to kind of say this, though. Like, last week when we talked about it, and again, it was cut off from the podcast, it was very much a declarative statement. It wasn't really, like, up for debate or anything, which, frankly, didn't really sound interesting from a podcast listening standpoint. And so I took the time to actually do a lot of research, and honestly, my views have changed a tiny bit, probably to an unexpected degree. You know, it might even actually, like, it might even turn, you know, opinions around in some ways. But more importantly, especially for the people who want to live in Japan, okay? So in order to kind of start talking about this, I do want to kind of start off with this article by Cliff Lezinski from May of 2012, right? So you know who Cliff Lezinski is, right, Daniel?
Cliffy B?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I know him.
Yeah, yeah. Gears of War.
Gears of War. the smash hit Lawbreakers.
I mean, I thought you were going to bring up Jazz the Jackrabbit or Unreal Tournament, but that's good too, I guess.
No, man. Fucking Lawbreakers tried to go up against Overwatch and died.
Yeah.
It just fucking died.
Which, off note, by the way, have you found Jazz the Jackrabbit in Horizon Zero Dawn?
I did not know that Jazz Jackrabbit was in Horizon Zero Dawn. Yes. What? What?
Let me know when you find him. Anyways.
Okay. I'm just picturing this giant anthropomorphic fucking rabbit in Horizon Zero Dawn, and that doesn't look right.
Okay, I'll have that vision, like, image in your brain gestate a little bit as I read this statement. Again, this is from a Gamasutra article interview from May 2012. My advice to Japan is that in a disc-based market right now, once again, 2012, you cannot ignore multiplayer, he says, adding, I'm not saying tack multiplayer onto every game. Grasshopper manufacturers Shadow of the Damned, which had a lot of critical praise but flew under the radar of the mainstream, was, quote-unquote, a wonderfully crazy adventure, says Blazinski. The dialogue had me laughing out loud, just even the key door systems in there. It was a beautifully crazy game with really fun gameplay, but no multiplayer co-op experience in there. Now, I'm not saying tack on versus, and there's a billion different ways you can do some sort of players interacting with other players. And if you're going to make a third-person shooter, the fact that Vanquish didn't have a multiplayer suite was a crime, he says. The shooter, developed by Platinum Games under the director Shinji Mikami, also failed to find a significant audience. So, the last statement, he says, calling the Demon's Souls / Dark Souls series, quote-unquote, one of the most innovative games for its passive multiplayer, he says that game is going to continue to inspire a lot of Western developers to figure ways you can have connected elements in campaign games and have more of a blended experience. This is by Cliffy B. So, do you agree with his statement right here? Like, I mean, what he's talking about?
Well, I mean, let's get this out of the way. Shadows of the Damned and Vanquish are fucking awesome.
Yes. So
I definitely agree with him there. Yeah. Those games are those are some of my favorite third-person shooters.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as he was saying that, like, that Japanese developers need to start focusing on multiplayer more, and that those two games didn't find footing because of their lack of multiplayer, I think it is valid. I can't really disagree with that. I mean, I don't think necessarily every game that has multiplayer is more successful just because of it. Because, I mean, Spec Ops The Line had multiplayer, and that didn't make the game sell millions or anything. So I guess I agree, but at the same time, there's evidence against it as well, is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I feel like he's coming from a time where a lot of Western developers were adding multiplayer just for the hell of it, right? Or if you remember 2012 and even the years before that, it was kind of a thing, remember? And let's not
forget. Yeah, it felt like it did feel like around that time that every fucking game coming out was a shooter of some kind, and that it had multiplayer.
And let's not forget, remember online passes?
Yes.
Yeah.
But then again, like, BioShock was successful, mm-hmm. and that didn't have multiplayer.
Exactly. So it's weird that he's saying this, obviously, during a time where there are single-player games that are successful. Naturally, this is from a bygone era. 2012 is no longer today, and that was exactly 6 years ago. But we have games these days that are attempting multiplayer in many different forms. Demon's Souls and Dark Souls, as he points out, is inspiring a lot of Western developers. I feel that, you know, the idea behind Dark Souls and Demon's Souls actually probably helped create the idea behind Destiny's online infrastructure in some shape, way, or form, you know? Especially with how seamless it was to just jump into somebody's game, right? I mean, at least we can agree on that, right?
Sure. I mean, that means nothing for me because I never played Destiny, but, you know, whatever.
I'm merely talking about the ease of getting into a game, like, right? Sure. Like, not going into a lobby, first of all. Because really, like, in Dark Souls, you just go into the game, right? And you're connected online always, and somebody jumps in and out of your game, right?
Yeah. I mean, kind of. In Dark Souls and in Demon's Souls, you need to be in human mode first in order for anyone to, like, jump into your game and invade you. Okay. However, you could still be in, like, in Demon's Souls, it was spirit mode, and in Dark Souls, it was, like, a hollowed form.
Mm-hmm.
But you would still be connected even in those forms, right. But the connectivity would be different, like...
Right.
You would, like, in those modes, I think it's only bloodstains that mm-hmm. you can see.
But essentially,
and the bloodstains show you how people died. Oh, and you also get messages. I almost forgot. You do also have access to player messages, which give you hints as to, like, what you're supposed to do next, or maybe give you advice of, like, oh, this next enemy you should attack with fire. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes people would use those messages to troll other players and tell them, oh, jump down here, there's treasure, and it might just lead you to your death.
Sure. So basically what you're trying to say is that, as you know, as quote-unquote smooth as the experience can be of just jumping into somebody's game, there are quite a bit of hoops you have to jump in order to even do that.
Well, I mean, if you want to play with another player, there are some hoops. If you mean just for invasions, it doesn't take much.
For any multiplayer.
In the Souls games?
Yeah.
Well, like I said, with invasions, you only need to be in human mode, which that doesn't really take much.
Okay.
Like, whatever. In Dark Souls, you use up a humanity, mm-hmm. whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Or you beat a boss, but humanities are like a dime a dozen. You can get them easily. It's mm-hmm. I think it's a little bit harder in Demon's Souls.
Okay.
But yeah, in Dark Souls especially, it's not that hard to, like, I remember by the end of Dark Souls, I had like tons of humanities, and I could go into human mode like whenever I felt like it.
Okay. All right. But even so, okay. Let's, I guess, ignore everything you said and just, like, kind of say, like, relatively speaking, it's, you know, you don't need to pull up a lobby, right? You don't need to pull up a friends list or something, right?
Like,
do any of that stuff. You just need to basically do whatever you do that you just explained, and you're into somebody's game. Meeting the requirements, of course, but essentially, I guess what I'm saying is the networking is abstracted by making the networking, quote unquote, part of the gameplay. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's like all very under the hood, and you're not interacting with that interface yourself. It's
exactly.
The game doing it for you.
Exactly. You know, and that's kind of like what I mean by comparing Dark Souls and Demon's Souls to Destiny, which sounds kind of silly, but you know, in Destiny, just to kind of illustrate for Daniel, when you go into a world, the game automatically connects you to, you know, up to like six other players so that you can randomly do activities together.
So that means that Destiny is the Dark Souls of shooters.
No. Let me backtrack. I will appreciate and say that you know, and I want to kind of make this clear. At first, I was kind of apprehensive when people compared like Monster Hunter World with like Dark Souls and stuff. But at the same time, you know, these days it's a good analog to easily describe a game to somebody. So I will accept.
Well, I
that.
Was doing it as a joke. Like I usually dislike it when people make those kind of arbitrary comparisons to the Souls series, because I feel like most of the time they're just doing it just because, and it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense.
Well, yeah, I mean, normally that's what happens, but like I've come
normally
to more or less, yeah, but I've come to kind of accept it as like, hey, okay, well, that's a thing that's gonna be, you know, done moving forward in history. That's not gonna change, sadly. But so, okay, we've made the comparison between Dark Souls and Destiny in terms of like how easy it is to jump into other people's games, et cetera, et cetera. We've established that, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're in agreement with that. So in Neo, and I'm going to start talking about like a few games here that kind of describe like what seems to be perhaps apprehension by the Japanese to deliver what something the West is already used to. And I think Destiny is a great way to kind of bridge all of these together, because in Destiny, really, whether you hate the game or not, it was truly easy to find other people to play with because you don't have to deal with it. The game is matchmaking you every single second you play the game, you know, and that's amazing. That makes the world feel whole, feel alive. You get what I'm saying? You know, you're not getting prompts, you're not getting like dialogue boxes and shit, like you're playing the game. Neo has this silly thing of, if you want to play games with your friends, and we've established before that you can play co-op in Dark Souls and Demon Souls, that in order to play co-op with your friends, one person needs to have finished the mission that your friend is already tackling. So
yeah.
Not only that, you need to have like an item to, you know, to collect it in order to join your friend, which seems to be a Dark Souls thing, right?
Yes, that's a Dark Souls thing.
Yeah. So in that sense, this really kind of bugs me, because Neo is listed as one of the best co-op games of 2017.
I would not agree with that. I mean, based on what I played of Neo, it seems to be a single-player game that just so happens to have some light co-op features.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So yeah. So calling it one of the best co-op games of the year is, like, dumb. Like, yeah. I don't mean to be rude, but that just sounds stupid.
No, I am totally in agreement with you. That's why when my girlfriend realized that Neo doesn't have, like, real co-op, she was really disappointed. She was actually getting into the gameplay, mind you. She was enjoying it. And then when she realized how much of a hoop we had to jump, like, it was like, okay, well, that's not cool anymore, you know? Which, by the way, it should be noted that even though Destiny 2 sucks nowadays, that we actually enjoyed the journey from level 1 to the max level of Destiny 2, mind you, excuse me, than Neo, because of the online experience. Just to kind of contextualize this, okay? Next, Splatoon 2. You were really surprised when I brought this up in our previous recording, but I'm going to restate it again. And hopefully you can feign ignorance and do the same reaction you had last week. Salmon Run. Salmon Run is a mode that is only available during certain times of the day and certain days of the week. Sometimes it could even be available when you're sleeping. And that is messed up.
What?
Yeah. That was a good impression, by the way. I think that's how you reacted last week, too, in some ways. Yeah. So, yeah, Nintendo, in their infinite wisdom, said, no, this will only be available to you on certain days. And I will get into the nitty-gritty of why, you know, the rationale behind this. But what did you think of this when you first heard it, or first heard about it, for that matter?
Stupid.
Okay. That's it?
That's it.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Well, if that...
What else is there to say? It's fucking dumb. Just let people play the mode whenever they fucking want to play it. What's the point?
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Okay. And actually, yeah, the last game that I'm going to actually mention is exactly why I went on this journey with y'all to begin with, and that's Monster Hunter World. And I hope you're ready for this, because when we talked about this last week, I didn't actually talk to you about, like, what's wrong with Monster Hunter World's multiplayer, but just the good parts about it, right? Right? Remember that? I mean, right? Okay. So, first of all, you can't do main story assignments with friends unless all participants have seen all the cutscenes for that mission.
Actually, I remember this, yeah. That's bad.
Yeah.
That's bad.
Yeah. Also, this is what I forgot. You can't join friends in story-based expedition quests. Expeditions are basically like the open-world exploration mode in the game. And if it's actually based off of the story that you have to go into expedition mode, you will never be able to join them.
Oh.
Yeah. So you can't...
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing. But you also can't join friends in expedition, just regular expedition mode, unless you send out an SOS flare. Which, by the way, your SOS flare will be visible for any person on the internet who has the game to be able to join. Even if you have, like, a password that locks your session or whatever the hell it is, anybody can join it. Anybody. Anybody.
Any fucking rando that just wants to just pop in and just shit all over your game.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's the only way that you can get a friend to join you in expedition. Or if you do side quests with your friends, you could just basically return to camp and now you're in expedition mode. Does this sound crazy to you? Like, just how
it sounds bad.
How challenging it is to actually get into a game with friends?
It sounds bad, man.
Sounds bad, man. Now, I know that I've been kind of slamming a lot of Japanese multiplayer, and to Japanese credit, not all of them have messed up, right? Dragon's Crown for the PlayStation 3 and the PlayStation Vita, you know, has a pretty good, you know, multiplayer system that is fairly good, actually. You know, like, it's even crossplay. You can play with people on the Vita and there's no problems whatsoever. You know, that's amazing. And really, after Dragon's Crown, and I'm talking about recent memory, right, Daniel? Like, apart mm-hmm. from Dark Souls and all that stuff, Japanese MMOs have been really good with this as well. Final Fantasy 14, Dragon Quest 10, and the Japanese/Asia-only Dragon's Dogma Online. These are all fairly smooth experiences when trying to play online. You know?
I remember playing Phantasy Star Online on my PC, the freeware mm-hmm. version, and that ran perfectly. Mm-hmm. I was able to play with my friends, and we all had a blast.
Yeah, with very minimal fuss, right? Like, I mean, you just basically meet up with them. Yeah, right?
Yeah, so, we just met up, and then we went dungeon crawling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the thing that's kind of crazy to think about. And this is actually what I... You know, because my girlfriend basically, like, asked me, like, well, have there been any Japanese games on recent memory that have actually nailed the online, right? And that's where I came up with this list. And I feel like it's fair when we're talking about Japanese online multiplayer to bring up the best ones. You know what I'm saying? You get where I'm coming from with this, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and you mentioned Splatoon 2 mm-hmm. with the dumb salmon run, but, like, I never had any problems with Splatoon 1's online.
Right. And really, ignoring the co-op, the multiplayer part is pretty straightforward as well, to some degree. You know, like, there's some weirdness there, like you can't change your gun when you're queuing up, which, you know, it is what it is, I think. But
yeah, I think you have to go to the shop to change it or something like that.
Something like that, yes. But you get what
Yeah. You don't have to go to the shop, but you have to be in the hub.
You just can't be queued and then change your weapon there. That's the requirement, okay? So, you guys are probably wondering, like, why are we discussing a lot of these things? These sound, like, really dumb and really much of a pain in the ass. Well, I'm going to tell you guys a story that I actually reheard, because I actually had watched this TED Talk before, and it's basically, like, a TED Talk by this lady who lived in Japan for quite a bit, I think, and in the story, she basically decided that she wanted to go to a store, or rather a restaurant, and order green tea with sugar. Now, green tea with sugar is a very Western thing to do. You know, normally, you know, green tea is just served green tea and you have to ask sugar for it, right? I mean, I've never done it, but can we at least agree on this, Daniel?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So the Japanese lady who was, you know, waitressing her and said, basically said, you know, in kind voice, one must not take sugar with their green tea. And so she basically said, and the lady basically said, well, in America, we take sugar with our green tea. So I'm going to ask you again, can I have green tea and sugar together? And the waitress basically said, in kind of like a nice but stern voice, one must not take sugar with green tea. And so she asked, the lady asked again. And this problem, apparently, Daniel, had to be escalated to the restaurant manager, by the way. Because apparently, really, green tea cannot be had with sugar. So the manager walks over to the lady's table, and the lady kind of like, you know, asked the question again, and then the manager said, I'm sorry, we don't have sugar. You with me so far?
Yes.
Okay. So the lady then asks, you know, and changes her mind and says, you know, look, I'm not going to have, green tea anymore. I just want to have some coffee, right? And so manager goes out, comes back with a cup of coffee and a couple of packets of sugar. Yeah. So basically, what this story can be applied to a lot of things, but I'm going to contextualize this using an interview conducted with one of the few Western designers that is part of Nintendo. Okay. And this is actually through this interview that I actually found that TED talk again. And really, this is to me very, very interesting. So I'm going to read the article if you don't mind, Daniel. So
go for it.
Okay. So they say, mind you, by the way, Splatoon 2 isn't the only game that they made. They also made Metal Gear Solid 5 with Kojima prior to Salmon Run or Splatoon 2, right?
Okay.
Yeah. In Japan, everything is tailored. In Japan, there is a sense of, quote unquote, we're making this thing for you, and this is how we think this thing is better enjoyed. This is why in Splatoon, the maps rotate every couple of hours and the modes change. Quote unquote, I bought this game, why can't I just enjoy this game the way that I want? That's not how the Japanese think here. Yes, you did buy the game, but we made this game, and we're pretty confident about how this game should be enjoyed. If you stick with us, and if you get past your initial resistance, you're going to have the time of your life with this game. You're really going to love it. This person additionally said, you have to trust us if you could you have to trust us. If you could play Salmon Run online anytime, that would result in a worse experience for you and everybody. So, needless to say, what these two articles are positing, these two stories are positing, is that there's some sort of Stockholm Syndrome-esque thing happening here where really, the Japanese developers want you to play the game the way that they want you to play it. And it almost kind of reminds me of the difference between an Apple user and a Windows user, right? A Windows user can basically build their Windows PC to however they want and all sorts of different configurations and, you know, fizzle widgets or whatever. But on the Mac, you're kind of limited to what they're made, you know, what they come in. Right? Like, it's like, okay, right. Well, you got a MacBook Air, great. You want to upgrade it, cool, but you can't do that after you buy the thing. How do you feel about this? Like, this is, because I feel like now we've gotten to a point where design isn't necessarily for the benefit of one particular country, except our own. And that's kind of like the weird vibe that I'm getting with some of the games, some of the multiplayer games that are coming from Japan in some ways.
So with the tea story specifically, I wanted to say that kind of strikes me more so as a really like warped version of traditionalism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is part of the problem where I think Now, I'm not gonna say like all Japanese people are like this. Obviously, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. But I would have to say that it's probably accurate to say that there are a lot of Japanese people who are very strongly rooted in this idea of traditionalism. So I don't, and I think it's not always the mindset of we're doing this because we know what's best for you, but rather this is how it's always been. Who are you to argue with that?
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. this is, we've, oh, you know, who are you to put sugar with green tea? We this is how green tea has always been enjoyed. Who are you to try and change that?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So while the other mindset you're talking about of, yeah, you have to trust us and because we think we know better, I think that may be part of it, but I think it's also combined with this just deep-rooted, you know, this is how it's always been, so this is how the way it's got to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I certainly agree with you with the tea thing, because that certainly sounds like very traditionalism, very much like cultural, you know, something that they've done for many, many years kind of situation, perhaps. Even.
And what I'm saying is that mindset may be also seeping into game design in some way.
Mm-hmm. But don't you think, though, that if already, even at that base level, that they're thinking that way, that it's pretty much permeated most of the culture? Because let's talk about like console wars in the same vein as well. Like, we've learned about three very risk averse companies, each with varying degrees of risk averseness and different ways to try to offset the risk averseness. You know what I'm talking about? To the point where they're not even going to risk it. Right.
So, right. It's, and again, just so nobody calls us racist, we're not saying all Japanese people are like this. What we are saying is that this is inarguably part of their culture.
Mm-hmm. And
I don't think anyone can really argue with us when we say that traditionalism is rooted in their culture.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And again,
yeah, like, and as a result, like you said, it is affecting their decisions.
Yeah, and
because it's what they grew up with.
Right, right, right. And I will get into more of that later on, like when we're ready to close down this segment, because I think it is very important to understand where these, you know, kinds of ideas are coming from. And, you know, unfortunately, like, I don't have the time to go all the way back in Japanese history to really find where that point started.
Right, we're just a couple of schlubs, you know, shooting the shit. Like, we're not Japanese history scholars.
Exactly. But, you know, one of the things that we do want to say, though, is this is an expected thing for a lot of Japanese people, you know, like, especially, you know, like, one of the things that I notice in most anime and even like some, you know, some Japanese dramas that I've seen is outward and open showness of feeling and emotion is kind of prohibited and almost looked down upon. You know, like, I actually, you know, I had a friend in college who did live in Japan. She's basically a Japanese citizen. And we're talking one day about, you know, because I was telling her, like, wow, you know, like, all these people, like, at the McDonald's and the KFC and stuff, they bow and stuff like that. And they're really so nice and stuff. And she basically, like, said, like, well, if you only knew what they were thinking of, really, right? And I asked her, like, what do you mean? And she's like, well, in Japanese culture, you're looked down upon if you openly show your emotion during work. I was like, what? That's the, like, really? It's like, yeah, you have to keep everything in yourself. You know, and I kind of started thinking about like the.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you've heard this, but I've heard this a few times, especially from Westerners that live in Japan. But they're almost all of them say this saying that's like a normal thing in Japan. The nail that sticks out gets hammered in.
Yeah.
A lot of Japanese culture is going with the flow. Don't stand out. Keep your head down. Mm-hmm. And just go with the crowd.
But also, I feel like, you know, the risk aversion conversation we have in console wars kind of plays into that as well, too, you know? Like, in guidebooks that talk about visiting Japan, a lot of them will actually say that a lot of Japanese actually do understand English, except they don't practice it because they're afraid that they're doing something wrong. That is actually in every book, like Fodor's, Lonely Planet. I've had a lot of like guidebooks about Tokyo and Japan in general, and all of them say this. And I'm like,
that learning English is wrong?
No, that they might know English, but they just don't want to be corrected, or that they don't want to be wrong.
Oh, that they might. Okay, I kind of misheard you then. Oh, okay, so they're so fearful of failure that they don't even expose. Try. They don't. Yeah, oh, damn. That's a fucked up way of looking at it. They don't even try because they're so afraid of failure. That's weird. I was actually one of my favorite musicians. This is gonna sound like a weird tangent, but it's not. One of my favorite musicians is Devin Townsend.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things about this guy is he actually has a song called Failure. And the song is actually about not being afraid of failure. You should embrace it because failure is human. And it's part of what makes us who we are. And we can't really grow unless we experience failure and move on from it.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like an interesting conversation because failure obviously is connected directly to choice. Right. Because obviously the more, you know, like in the West, we have a lot of choices. You know, I think that's kind of like the value of the West in general is that the more choices you have, generally the life is better. Now, I'm going to go back to that TED talk. And in case you guys are curious, if you guys are maybe watching this using the, you know, using clips and stuff, I am going to link the TED talk in the description and also probably added as a card to this video so you guys can actually watch it. And I'm going to try my best to summarize what I learned from this video because you would think that after telling you all this really bad stuff about Salmon Run, Dark Souls, and Monster Hunter World and Neo that I'm going to basically say, you know, they need to change. My reaction is maybe we need to understand why they locked it down this way. Or in very particular ways. And the reason why I'm saying this now is, again, in the TED Talk, what's kind of interesting is, like, this lady actually did a bunch of, you know, like, experiments. And humane experiments. they didn't just bully kids into doing these experiments or what have you. But essentially, they did experiments where there are choices that are limiting. And they basically had like an A, B, and C group where one had everything to do whatever they want. B, they had some limitations. And C, they had further limitations. And even telling them that, hey, your parents are expecting you to do this to the best of your ability in this specific way. And they found that in some cases, they found out that the lesser choices there are for the certain test subjects, the better informed their decisions were, even to the degree where the people who basically, or the kids who basically like made the thing for her parents, you know, one of the kids even said like, I hope my mommy likes this or something like that, you know, because they made it to a very specific specification. Here's a darker example, and I hope people are ready for this because I feel like this is actually very telling. And I feel like it is very cultural, right? And this is an example that really touched me deeply because I really didn't think of choice in this sort of grave manner. Excuse the pun. In Europe, there was a, you know, let's just say like there was this mother who gave birth to a baby. And essentially what happened was that there is a chance that, you know, the baby that they have was going to die within, you know, a few hours or something like that. You know, let's say that the scenario happens in both Europe and the United States, for that matter. I don't necessarily know what European country this happened. So I unfortunately, that's something you guys will have to watch in a video. But in Europe, they essentially did not give the parents the option to do whatever they want and instead basically just said that they basically made the decision for them, which is, you know, unfortunately, I don't want to get into the detail, but you get what I'm saying, right? Like they basically made the decision for the couple to, you know, not prolong their kid's life.
Right.
In the United States, they were given the option, and they actually, you know, obviously they whatever decision they have, that doesn't really matter. But here's the interesting part. In Europe, when this same thing happened, they said that they did a test to see how faster these guys recovered, and the people in Europe recovered faster within a year's time of this sorrowful event than the people in the West, in the United States. And when asked about this event, and I'm kind of getting a little emotional talking about this, the parents in the United States who lost their kid basically said, like, it's like the doctor gave us the gun in our hand and asked us if we want to shoot the gun or not. Think about that for a second, Daniel.
No, yeah, that's brutal.
Yeah. So, and mind you, the TED Talk isn't necessarily about anything too serious, even though this is a serious subject matter. But the implication that there needs to be more of an understanding why choice is either shrinked or expanded depending on what country, nationality, or place that you're in. There are really good reasons why they are in place, and sometimes when we are forced into a certain situation that we might have limited choices, we might actually make better informed decisions because of it. Like a lighter example would be this. What if you basically went to the supermarket, but they have 100 different options for chips? Really, how long does it take you to make a decision unless you really went in the store beforehand or already had an idea of what to get? Like, let's say before that, you already decided what Doritos. But even then, you're probably staring at all the Doritos and saying, shit, what flavor do I want? And you're faced with
Cool 10. Ranch.
Well, okay, so you obviously know what you want, but like...
Yeah, boy.
But in general, like, let's say you are not familiar with a brand and you wanted something new. Now you're staring there at, like, you know, 15 different flavors, and you're like, which one's good? Maybe you look it up online. So immediately, it doesn't, what I'm positing is immediately, the more choice you have doesn't necessarily mean that the choice that you're picking from is easy, right? I mean, you get where I'm getting at, right?
Yeah, just because you have more choice, that's not necessarily like a good thing.
Yeah, it's almost paralyzing in some ways.
That I think that's actually what it's called, like paralyzed by choice. Uh-huh. I think that's an actual thing.
Yeah, that's an actual phrase too, because that does happen. I know, like, we kind of took a lot of detours and stuff and side notes and all that stuff, and I don't even know if people are going to understand what I'm saying, like, on the clips or even listening to this, but what I'm getting at is that, you know, I was formerly frustrated with, like, how Monster Hunter World's, you know, online happens, and I'm still kind of frustrated with how Salmon Run in Splatoon 2 is limited and stuff, but maybe we need to kind of take a step back and think about this for a second. And maybe, you know, whatever they're saying might be right, because it sounds wrong because we live in a country or in a place, maybe. A lot of people who listen to the show could not be in the United States, and that's totally fine. But there are other places in the world where freedom of choice isn't necessarily as wide as the United States. And there are traditionalist views that might come to play here in terms of Japanese, but also not just that, also in different places in Europe and Asia as well, you know? And I feel like it'll do us more as individuals to kind of take a step back and kind of really recognize that maybe, you know, I'm going to give this a shot anyway, even if it doesn't seem like it aligns with my views as what this game or book or movie or what have you should do. You get where I'm getting at?
Yeah.
Because, like, it, you know, and this is kind of born out of a lot of entitlement that I've kind of been seeing a lot, too, in, you know, social media when it comes to games.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I would say that a sense of entitlement is one of the biggest problems going on right about now.
But that's also, you know, that's also caused by culture clash, you know, and that's kind of like where I'm coming from with this. And this is, I know this is very long-winded and stuff like that. And maybe a lot of you guys don't actually mind some of the limitations they placed in Monster Hunter World, you know, and really, honestly, at the end of the day, I actually don't mind them anymore. You know, like, I feel like they're just a sad necessity that I have to work around it and stuff, but pretty sure.
I would also say that that's probably due to the fact that now you have a better understanding.
It could be too. I mean, I feel like to me, the way that I saw Monster Hunter World is this is their solution to a potential problem, which is spoilers and all that stuff, you know? Like, so that's why they kind of rigged it the way that they did, so that unfortunately you're kind of inconvenienced to see all the cutscenes before you join a friend. But at the same time, you know, like, at least nobody's spoiling the game for you. There's no, you know, like, there are reasons. There are good reasons why certain games do the things that they do. And I think it's important to try to put ourselves even, you know, in a different person's shoe and kind of think, like, whether or not they're, you know, they're actually true or not. Because sometimes, it's a good solution, you know?
Well, I do think that happens a lot where people are up against something in a game that they don't like, and they don't really take the opportunity or the chance to really think about, okay, but why is this the way it is?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer sometimes might surprise them, and you might realize, oh, well, it has to be this way because maybe there actually is no alternative. I can't think of what it was exactly, but I remember I was talking to a friend of mine once, and he asked, like, oh, why'd they do it like this? And I explained to him, like, oh, because you could exploit it or something. I forget the context. I forget exactly what it was. But I remember it was just this moment where, like, he didn't understand. I had to explain to him. And then he went, like, oh, okay, I guess that does make sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And really, like, the reasoning behind some of the decisions of these games, you know, make a lot of sense, too, in a way. Like, Salmon Run, I feel like, even though it sounds absurd, you know, especially, you know, in Splatoon in general, right? Like, not being able to play whatever map you want sounds silly, right? Like, it sounds crazy if you think about it. But then look at the other Western games that have adopted a similar idea, right? Like, in Overwatch, you can't actually pick what map you play in unless you set up a custom game. Because it's set on a rotation, right? I mean, really, that's what that is. But people are okay with that, you know? So there are merits to some of the decisions certain people make when it comes to their games or their movies and stuff like that. It's just, I wish a lot more people would consider the rationale behind it as opposed to having a gut reaction, including myself. I'm including myself in this as well. Instead of feeling entitled that it should be done a very specific way. You know, and it's interesting to kind of tie this all together because, you know, kind of going back to the whole Apple Windows thing, I actually like Macs more than PCs, and because I don't like having to deal with the choice, you know, so it's interesting.
See, I'm the opposite. I prefer PC.
And that's,
fuck,
you know,
Macs.
And that's fine. But, you know, it's kind of interesting that I complained about a very specific thing because there's not enough freedom of choice, whereas in certain things, I'm okay with limited choice. You get where I'm getting at?
Yeah, we all have our different preferences for that sort of thing.
Yeah, but like in terms of like philosophical choice, that's kind of an interesting split there. And that's something that I want to leave people with and stuff. It's like, you know, really, let's think about like what drives people's decisions first before we judge. Because again, I'm not absolved of this, even though I've tried to make a point out of this conversation. But either way, I hope like you guys at least got something out of this that's very constructive and makes you guys think about like, you know, the choices that you make in everyday life. So,
or even like the concept of making a choice.
Exactly. So, all right, that was a pretty deep subject matter for a podcast about video games. So let's
talk about video games.
So let's talk about video games. And actually, we're going to close this segment out by starting with the community question for this week. And the community question this week is pretty crazy. So I have the context of this on the actual video itself, but, you know, speaking of Monster Hunter World, the food in that looks great. The food in Final Fantasy 15 looks great. And naturally, like, you know, the pizza that the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles pull out for Injustice 2 is also pretty great. So my question this week is, what video game dish would you like to try in real life? So what's yours, Daniel? What is your pick for this?
So I'm a person with a sweet tooth. So because of that, I've always wondered what it would what the gels from the Tails series would taste like. Each of the Tails games have these different gels that act as your healing items. Apple gels, grape gels, mango gels. And they all sound so tasty. And I'm just like, the mango one especially, that's what I want to eat. I want to know what that tastes like, because it probably tastes delicious.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow, that's a good choice. I even forgot about the gels for a second there. That's a great choice. But just the gels, though? Like, nothing, like, you know, savory and stuff? Like, your kids?
Well, I was under the impression I could only choose one thing.
I mean, you know, I guess dishes. You should probably make that clear next time.
I mean, I'm just going to stick with that choice because I can't think of anything else right now, but...
I'll tell you, yeah, okay.
Because each of the games, they give you a little picture, and it looks like a little glob, and it's red or pink or orange, and they all look so tasty. I just want to eat it. It looks good.
Okay, I'll add this to my choices too, because I have a different answer on the video. The tonkatsu bowls that you get in Yakuza when you go to the convenience store, I want to try those, just out of curiosity. If they're actually good.
Yeah, a lot of the food in the Yakuza games looks scrumptious.
Yeah, exactly. So there's so much food in video games, it's kind of crazy to think about.
the thing is, though, with Yakuza, that's all real food. And that's why I picked the gels from the Tales series, because that's a fantasy food.
Hmm, I see.
And that's why I find that to be a more interesting choice for me, because... I could theoretically go out and eat all the food that's in Yakuza. I can't eat an apple gel. I can't eat a mango gel. Unless Bandai Namco, for whatever reason, decides they want to sell it.
Don't give them ideas.
I'll give them the idea. Fucking do it.
Because did you know that there is an actual Final Fantasy potion that they sold for a time?
It's probably like an energy drink or something.
You think so? Now I'm going to Google it, because now we're in a conversation.
I know that there is a Mega Man energy tank.
Yes.
That you could buy. And that, I think that was definitely a energy drink. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a Street Fighter energy drink as well.
Mm-hmm. Well... Potion is a brand of drinks named after the recurring healing item in Final Fantasy produced by Suntory. If you remember, Suntory was basically like the wine company that Bill Murray does an advertising for, like in that one movie with Scarlett Johansson. God damn it, why did I forget the name of that movie? You know what I'm talking about, right?
Nope.
Why did I forget that movie? That's terrible. It was actually one of my favorite movies. Lost in Translation. Lost in Translation.
Oh, that's what it's called?
Yeah.
Actually, yeah, I heard that was a good movie.
Oh, you never seen it? Okay. Yeah, because Bill Murray does like an ad for Suntory Wine, and it's the same company that made the Potion brand of drinks, apparently. I'm actually trying to find like the price, because I'm pretty sure it's insanely expensive.
It probably is. It's probably been out of production for a while now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's no fucking way. Like, man, oh, man. I'm, like, thinking about it now. I'm like, man, does somebody else have it that haven't drank it? Oh, my God. Yeah, it's like, you know, like, there's, like, this one show that I was listening to a long time ago where they would get, like, old-ass drinks from, like, many, like, decades ago and start drinking
Crystal
it,
Pepsi.
Oh. Yeah. And, man, that's just That's wrong. That's wrong. Okay, before anybody else gets any ideas to send us, like, Final Fantasy potions or anything like that.
Or Crystal Pepsi.
Or Crystal Pepsi. Do you want to talk... God, do you want to talk about, like, your channel and what you're doing on your channel for the next few weeks or something?
Well, I just finished beating Shadow of the Colossus from start to finish.
Yeah.
So you could check that out in my playlist of unlisted streams.
Okay.
If you so desire. And as for what I'm working on next, still the same stuff. I've actually had a really busy week. I haven't had as much of a chance to work on stuff as I would have liked. But stuff is still in production. Stuff is still being made. I actually was thinking of also streaming Grandia 2 one of these days because I really like that game.
Okay.
And I was thinking it'd be fun to stream it, and that would kind of kickstart like me replaying the game and maybe making a video on that, because someone suggested, like, hey, you should do a video on Grandia 2. That would probably lead to some good material. And I'm like, yeah, why not? I haven't played that game in a long time, so yeah.
Okay. So cool.
So if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's at Shintai Reviews. Please talk to me. I'm very open to discussion.
Awesome.
You know, shoot your questions, or, you know, if you just want to chat, go ahead. And if you want to subscribe to me on YouTube, it is youtube.com/Shintai Reviews.
Excellent. And of course, if you survived that entire talk about Japanese culture, you can follow me on Twitter at MyBacklogBattle. Once again, that is twitter.com/MyBacklogBattle. And of course, we have the Backlog Battle YouTube channel at youtube.com/MyBacklogBattle, where we have the community question, which we release every week. We have clips from the latest episode of the podcast, even before the podcast comes out in some days. And of course, the brand new series, Travel Eorzea, where you get to get a glimpse of Final Fantasy XIV without actually paying for the subscription and being able to see, like, the sights and the sounds and stuff that, which, by the way, I don't know if you know this, Daniel, a lot of people who actually watch this video who are even players of Final Fantasy XIV are even super surprised about some of the locations that I've been showing them, because they've never actually seen them in the game. Just kind
of... Oh, damn.
It's really fascinating. So if you guys want to really check that out, again, it's Travel Eorzea. It's on youtube.com/MyBacklogBattle. And of course, if you like this episode of the podcast, please like, share, and subscribe to this podcast. We highly recommend Overcast. Overcast is a great iTunes, you know, Android, iPhone app. I think it might be out on, like, other platforms as well. It's a fantastic app. You guys should check it out and stuff. It's almost always updated with, like, you know, new podcasts and information. It basically updates the same time as our iTunes entries and stuff. And best of all, it's free and it's unobtrusive. So you guys should go check it out. And of course, if you don't...
Free is good.
And of course, there's also, you know, like, iTunes podcast, and of course, on Android at Google Play. Unfortunately, we are not supporting Stitcher anymore because they kind of suck. So, and I'm not afraid to say that. So a lot of people have been kind of hounding me on Twitter saying, like, they're missing episodes of the Backlog Battle podcast on Stitcher. And unfortunately, we have no control over that. So if you guys are trying to find an alternative, check out Overcast. I think you guys will really enjoy it. So, all right. Anyways, guys, thank you very much for joining us. We'll see you guys next week. Happy gaming, and we'll see you guys later.